at the University of Tennessee at Chattanooga, where he's also a professor of history. Since 1999, he's been there. He has also taught at Georgetown University, Tulane University, Johns Hopkins University, and the University of Dallas, and is a senior scholar at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars in Washington, D.C., and a senior fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center in Washington, also a senior fellow of the Trinity Forum and a member of the Society of Scholars at the James Madison Program of Princeton University. He has served since 2002 as a member of the National Council on the Humanities, the Advisory Board for the National Endowment for the Humanities, and is Vice Chairman of the newly created Jack Miller Center for the Teaching of America's Founding Principles. He is the author of The Masterless, Self and Society in Modern America, which won the 1995 Merle Curti Award of the Organization of American Historians for the Best Book in American Intellectual History, published in the years 1993 and 1994. Among his other books are The Student's Guide to U.S. History, Religion Returns to the Public Square, Figures in the Carpet, and a forthcoming collection of essays entitled The Burden of the Humanities. He is currently at work on a biographical study of the American sociologist David Reisman and is editing a collection of his own scattered essays entitled Pieces of a Dream, Historical and Critical Essays. He held the Royden B. Davis Chair of Interdisciplinary Studies at Georgetown University for the academic year of 1988 and 89, and among his other awards include the following. He was a Fulbright Senior Lecturer in American Studies for the spring of 2007 at the University of Rome. He's been the recipient of fellowships from the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars, the National Endowment for the Humanities, the National Academy of Education, and the Howard Foundation. He was the co-editor of Rowan and Littlefield's book series entitled The American Intellectual Culture and has served on the editorial boards of such magazines as First Things, The Wilson Quarterly, The Public Interest, American Quarterly, and Touchstone. He was educated at St. John's College and also Johns Hopkins University, where he received his PhD in history. Will you join me in welcoming Dr. Wilfred McLeod?
Well, it all goes downhill from there. But I'm delighted to be with you. I've been looking forward to this for a long time. We set this up 6 months ago or so. So I've wanted to come to this college, this university, for a long time. I've heard wonderful things about it. And so far, so good. I've been on the campus for, about 20 minutes, and nothing bad has happened. And as you'll see, the question of expectations figures large in my what I have to say. I'm not going to preach to you, but I do want to borrow from the tradition of expository preaching by beginning with a scripture quotation, which I then can return to, sort of like a rondo theme, through the course of my remarks, and it like so much of the scriptures, it unpacks marvelously into all sorts of meanings you wouldn't have suspected when you first laid eyes on it. For this purpose, I've chosen the second of the Beatitudes from the Sermon on the Mount, the Gospel of Matthew, chapter 5, verse 4. Very familiar to you. Blessed are those who mourn, for they will be comforted. It's a very strange, almost disturbing phrase, and certainly a strange combination in the context of a lecture on happiness. What does this have to do? What do Christ's words have to do with happiness? And that's the burden of proof in what follows. A perfect example of how the gospel turns things upside down and understands the world rightly by doing so. Okay. In approaching the subject of happiness, I'm often reminded of the start of the great Russian novel Anna Karenina, some of you have probably read, by Tolstoy, and famous first sentence. You know, it's one of those books that everybody knows the first sentence. Not everybody. Don't feel bad if you don't know, but in fact, I hope a few of you have never heard this before. And the sentence goes like this: happy families are all alike. Every unhappy family is unhappy in its own way. Happy families are all alike. Every unhappy family is unhappy in its own way. Well, you know what he means, sort of. I mean, the annals of human history are full of disappointment and misery. You know, this aspect of history seems endless. And actually, we're more fascinated, aren't we, by tales of woe than we are tales of joy. Everyone prefers Dante's Inferno to his Paradiso. And tabloid newspapers never want for a juicy copy. Even the best novelist is going to find that words fail him or her after a storyline runs to, and they all lived happily ever after. That tends to be where the story either changes course or ends. But given all of that, I think Tolstoy was mistaken. I think, in fact, it is human happiness that is various and fertile and mysterious. It comes in many sizes and shapes and colors, reflects the wondrous variety of the human condition and the infinitely diverse ways that God has gifted us and works in our lives. Looking at the matter from the high standpoint of joy, it's unhappiness that seems ploddingly uniform and gray and predictable. Also, Tolstoy misses the element of gift in happiness. His words reflect the assumption that happiness is our normal condition, what we might say is our default setting. This may be easy to believe, especially when we are young, as some of you are, especially here in prosperous, somewhat less prosperous than 6 months ago, but prosperous nonetheless, modern America. We assume that if we aren't constantly happy and smiling and cheerful with brilliant white teeth, perfectly arranged by the modern advances of orthodontia, that there must be something wrong with us. We assume that the pursuit of happiness, referred to in our Declaration of Independence, means the finding of happiness. But, of course, you don't need me to tell you that that is not so. To pursue, as every young man knows from his early experience, pursue is not necessarily to catch. And few things are as rare as a deep and genuine and enduring happiness. That, too, is a fact that Tolstoy's famous sentence fails to capture, although his books come far closer. It's almost impossible to speak about happiness without sounding like a child or a cynic, or more likely a purveyor of tired truisms. The problem is that while happiness is a subject of central importance in our existence, a matter of irrepressible significance to us, many of the most reliable truths may come across as disappointing, flat, trite, commonplace. Surely, we think to ourselves, this elusive thing that we all pant after can't have been captured by a sugary Hallmark card inscription or the maudlin lyrics of a country western song. That would be too much to bear, especially for those of us who consider ourselves intellectuals and pride ourselves on our superior sense of life's complexity and depth. It all makes me think back to a conversation I had a number of years ago with an unhappy friend, a rather theatrical and self-absorbed character, who was then buckling under the strain of his failing marriage, badly in need of some straight advice. So I began to, being the straight man, I offered straight advice, some rather basic, sensible suggestions. How about establishing a date night? How about giving her flowers? So on. And he cut me off with a violent wave of his hand and burst out saying, "Why am I condemned to live in such a trivial and banal world?" Except he said banal world. A trivial and banal world. It was hard to tell whether it was the marriage or the banality that bothered him more. Actually, though, it was both. My friend and his doomed, as it turned out, marriage was suffering from his failure to grasp one of the few maxims about happiness that one can repeat without wincing. And this is it. Write it in your notes. Happiness is a matter of having the right expectations. That you can take to the bank. But don't leave yet. When you stubbornly expect the world to be something different from what it is, whether lesser or greater, the result is rarely a happy one. The mortifying fact is we often get better practical guidance from such matters from someone like, let's say, Dale Carnegie, who said the following: success is getting what you want. Happiness is wanting what you get. Which actually, corny as it is not a bad observation. Much better that than the profundities of the smart alecks and wits of the world's wise guys, such as the professors, the class of professors to which I belong. So it's a banal world, if I may pronounce it correctly, banal world sometimes, and the truth is often a lot simpler than we care to believe. And, I might add, the Christian view of human nature as fallen and corrupt and saved only by grace has endured because it finds confirmation in the facts. If we take in that view of ourselves fully, it changes our expectations of ourselves and others and makes our happiness, paradoxically, more possible. We tend to think of happiness and the quest for it as one of the timeless and immutable goals of human existence, perhaps even the most timeless of all. But as the historian Darren McMahon has pointed out in his superb book called Happiness, A History, and the title gives you a hint at what I'm about to say, our age's approach to the pursuit of happiness is far from being the norm of human history. What we mean by happiness is different from what others have meant. Given that fact, our own wrestlings with the subject today may benefit greatly from our taking account of the perspective provided by happiness's past. To do this requires a journey through the cultural and moral history of the West, the Western world, not the Wild West. Although I'm sure you could learn a great deal from that, too. In the process, I'll be making a case for the central importance of ideas in history, which is, of course, a very self-interested thing for me to do since that's my job, intellectual history. But you might say, what do ideas have to do with happiness? Well, everything. Because, getting back to the question of expectations, the pattern of expectations to which the pursuit of happiness conforms itself in any given time period, that age's vision of felicity, so to speak, and the means you use to get there, that is itself the product of the dominant ideas of the time in question. Ideas about death, God, life, nature, causality, moral responsibility, and human possibility. In a word, what we believe about the world's structure and meaning will determine what happiness, or what we think happiness is, and how we can act to gain it for ourselves. What we believe provides the basic structure of what we expect. Okay, let me take you on this magical mystery tour, a very fast tour of sort of dominant peaks of the Western view of happiness. Let me begin, of course, with the ancient Greeks and the moral universe of Homer's epics and Sophocles' tragedies. For them, happiness was a quite different matter from what we understand it to be today, because the universe was something different. The universe, for them, was a cruel and mysterious place, governed by dark, incomprehensible forces, entirely beyond human understanding. Human beings had to make their way in the face of feckless, to put it mildly, gods. Gods that commanded respect only for their power, not for anything else. And, paradoxically mixed in with the gods, was a notion of pitiless fate, the capital F. For them, the Greeks, that is, happiness in life could be had only on the fly, and it was revocable at a moment's notice by the most chance and incomprehensible events, which may or may not be related to anything that you did, any concept of dessert or justice or meaning. So happiness is, for them, something that befalls us, that happens to us. Notice the connection between happiness and happen. I'll get to that in a moment. Hence, there's a consistent theme in ancient Greek literature that no man should be considered happy until his death. It was given particularly sharp expression in the Greek lawmaker Solon, who observed that in a world of radical uncertainty, one can count no living man happy, for to many the god has shown a glimpse of blessedness only to extirpate them in the end. Don't trust those gods. Happiness was not a subjective state of joy or well-being, but a characterization of a whole life. And paradoxically, one could only finally be counted as happy when one was no longer around to experience happiness. There are many iterations of this. Count no man happy until he's dead. Sophocles says it, Euripides says it, Aeschylus says it, Homer says it, you know, they all say it. This tragic view, if I could call it that, of happiness is hardly restricted to ancient Greece, though, as one can deduce from the word itself. The word happiness is linked to the Middle English word hap, from which we get words such as happenstance and perhaps. In other words, for much of the world, over much of human history, happiness has been something that happens to one. You receive it passively rather than achieve it actively. But it also was in ancient Greece, specifically in democratic Athens, the 5th century, that a different approach begins to emerge. It was a product of the social and political experience of the time, an experience of self-rule, of the republic. Small R, republic, which established and reinforced the idea that free men could, through rational inquiry and persuasion, rational persuasion, find ways to decide things for themselves and thereby exert some control over the conditions of their existence. This development brings the question of happiness to the fore very quickly. In Plato's dialogue, they're called Euthydemus. Socrates, I hope I've said that correctly, Socrates took it as a given that all men desire happiness and that a right ordering of our lives can produce happiness. Aristotle saw happiness as the proper end, the telos, the end in the sense of a fulfillment, of a terminus that fulfills one's nature. The end, the telos of human existence was happiness, a flourishing of the soul that naturally arises out of its rightly ordered activities, according to the universally intelligible standard of reason. In this new view, men are in some, and I use the term men generically, of course, men are in some sense meant to be happy in this world. And there should be no mystery about how they get there. Of course, this view was far from being universal in scope, since only a very few exceptional people, and I think I could say men in the non-generic sense, a few exceptional men, could ever hope to attain this happiness. And the Christian view of happiness further complicates matters when it comes along, grounded as it was in an ambivalent attitude towards the world. And of course, Christians, you know, speak of the world in a reified way, the world. When I use the word ambivalent, by the way, I mean that it points in two different directions at the same time, a condition that we often try to express by the phrase in the world but not of the world. It affirmed the world in ways that reflected Christianity's Jewish and Greek roots. But at the same time, the emphasis on the doctrine of original sin and the consequent need for divine grace as a means of salvation seem to remove from individuals the power to effect their own happiness. The search for perpetual felicity in God's eyes, in God's presence, often seemed in some versions of the Christian faith to negate the enjoyment of the world's passing felicities in favor of a concentration on the bread of heaven and the rewards or punishments of the afterlife. And although it would be very wrong indeed, to call Christianity an otherworldly religion, it is not inaccurate to say that at bottom the Christian understanding of man seemed to entail the view that unhappiness, not happiness, was his natural condition. This view was slow to change and has not disappeared. In our own history, the Puritans of New England rarely spoke of personal happiness, but were more likely to speak of what they called peace of conscience or comfort of heart, believing that happiness as such was something that would not be fulfilled this side of heaven. Communal worship, marital love, which the Puritans did engage in, by the way, I assure you, and not furtively either. The Puritans get a terrible bad rap. That's another lecture for another occasion. Communal worship, marital love, these were foretastes of heaven, but only foretastes. And even then, happiness was always something experienced in relationship with others as part of a body, as part of a social body, and not individually. But with the coming of modernity, a new picture of things gradually begins to supplant this view and the ancient view in general. I told you this was a very quick, dirty version of Western history. Some of this change occurred within the Christian faith itself. Some of it was reflected in developments like John Locke's understanding of the human mind as a blank slate upon which experience wrote, which meant there were no innate ideas, including sin. Or the Scottish moralist Francis Hutcheson, a major influence on Thomas Jefferson, author of the Declaration of Independence, who thought that man had an innate moral sense which made men hardwired to do good and thereby have the power to enhance their own happiness. However one itemizes the influences, and some people would do it differently than I just have, it was the advent of what we call, vaguely but importantly, the Enlightenment that marked the decisive change, creating the idea of happiness that dominates our own time. An idea which envisions happiness as something that all human beings can rightly aspire to in the here and now as a natural expression of their natural human endowment. The historian Roy Porter put it this way. I think this is a wonderful, succinct expression. The Enlightenment translated the ultimate question, how can I be saved, into the pragmatic, how can I be happy? And the answer increasingly was through human effort and understanding alone. By the time of the American Revolution, the pursuit of happiness was one of the, quote, self-evident truths to which Thomas Jefferson felt free to recur in writing the Declaration of Independence, which, of course, he stressed was not meant to be an original document, but merely a harmonization of the views that were generally held in the time. So there is, in a word, no more characteristically modern assumption than the belief that it lies within our power to find happiness. But the story doesn't end there, of course. For one thing, there are immense difficulties, and this is, I suspect, part of what you've been talking about in these previous sessions. There are immense difficulties in the modern regime of self-generated happiness. Even without getting into biotechnology, it's a regime filled with paradox. The self-conscious pursuit of happiness often leads to unhappiness, an unhappiness that is only intensified by the perception that one's unhappiness is entirely one's own responsibility, precisely because we assume that happiness is or should be something within our power to achieve for ourselves. So the experience of being unhappy, which is bad enough in itself, is made even worse by the sense of failure that attends it. Not only are you unhappy, but it's your fault that you're unhappy. You have the little inner voice that tells you this? I think some of us have experienced that. And in its most sophisticated expression, the Enlightenment Project has led to a renunciation of the very possibility of happiness, as in these cheerful words of Sigmund Freud, a very cheerful fellow. Quote, "The program of becoming happy, which the pleasure principle imposes on us, cannot be fulfilled." Even on those occasions when Freud lightened up a little bit and was more optimistic sounding, his mechanistic prescriptions do little to enhance our sense of human dignity and purposefulness. Here's another Freud quote. "Happiness, in the reduced sense in which we recognize it as possible, is a problem of the economics of the individual's libido." One could be grateful Jefferson didn't put that into the Declaration of Independence. Although I imagine some at times have wanted to have it there. All of which suggests that the ancient Greeks and the earliest Christians both knew something about man, generic man, that modernity has failed to repeal, even if it has managed to forget it. Indeed, one might ask, has modern man's self-conscious pursuit of happiness made happiness all the more difficult to achieve? Consider this passage from Alexis de Tocqueville's Democracy in America, a wonderful book. That, as I say, it's the desert island book on America, even though it was published a century and a half ago. If you're more than that, if you have only one book about America on a desert island, this is the book. This is from a chapter of the book called Why the Americans Are Restless in the Midst of Their Prosperity. It gives you a sense of how a guy writing in the 1830s was on to something. In certain remote, this is Tocqueville here, this is a fairly lengthy passage. So, "In certain remote corners of the old world, you may still sometimes stumble upon a small district that seems to have been forgotten amid the general tumult, and to remain stationary while everything around it was in motion. The inhabitants, for the most part, are extremely ignorant and poor. They take no part in the business of the country and are frequently oppressed by the government. Yet their countenances are generally placid and their spirits light. In America, I saw the freest and most enlightened men placed in the happiest circumstances that the world affords. But it seemed to me as if a cloud habitually hung upon their brow, and I thought them serious and almost sad, even in their pleasures." Continuing with Tocqueville, why is this the case? "The chief reason for this contrast is that the former, the poor and ignorant in the forgotten corner of the old world, the former do not think of the ills they endure, while the latter are forever brooding upon advantages they do not possess. It is strange to see what feverish ardor the Americans pursue, with what feverish ardor the Americans pursue their own welfare, to watch the vague dread that constantly torments them, lest they should not have chosen the shortest path which may lead to it." It's almost as if he'd driven on an American highway. "The paradox here is that happiness may prove even more elusive for an age that embraces the all-out, unashamed, naked pursuit of it by whatever means. Think of it in terms of the expectations game that I mentioned a while back. The modern Americans that Tocqueville describes have been taught by their culture's assumptions to come to life with a very different set of expectations from those of the ignorant and isolated peasants. And coming at life with the wrong expectations can distort our very sense of our own humanity. One of the most powerful witnesses to that fact was Aldous Huxley, who I'm sure you've talked about already here, but whose novel Brave New World, published in 1932, continues to grow in stature as our world comes increasingly to resemble it. In the novel's world, as one character says, everybody's happy. Thanks to endless free sexuality, you've come to the right place, sir. Well, it's true. That's true. Let me start that again. In the novel's world, as one character says, everybody's happy thanks to endless free sexuality. This is just a novel we're talking about here. Endless consumer goods, endless youth, mood-altering drugs, and all-consuming entertainment. Remember the feelies. But the novel's hero, a fellow called the Savage, no relation to Michael Savage, I presume, stubbornly proclaims, quote, the right to be unhappy, and dares to believe that there might be more to life than pleasure. And this is his refrain. Sounds a little sophomoric, but it's passionate enough. I want God. I want poetry. I want real danger. I want freedom. I want goodness. I want sin. In the end, the Savage is put on display by the wonderfully named leader Darwin Bonaparte, as if he were a zoo animal, literally the last man, although not in the Nietzschean sense of last man, but that's another story. Why are our sympathies so strongly drawn to this guy? Who in his right mind would want to endorse unhappiness? Could it be because we know in our bones that unless we are sometimes willing to be unhappy, we will soon be unwilling to be human? Could it be that this Savage is in fact the novel's proxy for humanity itself? Huxley thought so. He knew that there was something radically unharmonizable in the human spirit, a restlessness built into the constitution of our humanity that could not be stilled or stifled by a regime of mere good feeling or willingly be sacrificed for its sake. Unless, that is, one is willing to give up on the peculiar betweenness of humanity itself, the riddle that every serious thinker since the dawn of human history has tried to understand and that the Christian faith alone adequately answers. Huxley's most disturbing but also most prophetic observation is this one: the fear that in the relentless search for happiness, human beings would endeavor to alter their very nature, tampering with the last bastion of fate, their genetic constitution. Should that happen, supreme irony of ironies, the search for human happiness would culminate in the gradual elimination of the human race as we know it, beginning with the infirm and disabled and ending who knows where. That very prospect may be upon us now. This is, of course, not really so different from the self-subverting pattern of the modern totalitarian ideologies, which all sought to produce happy societies by abolishing the independence and dignity of the individual. Yet the lure of post-humanity may be the particular form that the temptation manifests itself in our own technologically advanced Western liberal democracies. If we take such a step in a quest to live as gods, Huxley's words, we will be leaving much of our humanity behind. And one of those things also left behind may ironically be happiness itself. Perhaps the self-conscious pursuit of happiness is yet another iteration of the eating of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, which brought the pain of self-consciousness and shame into the world. Perhaps we need to be less self-conscious in order to be happy. This very point has been picked up, albeit in a very secular form, by the psychologist Daniel Gilbert of Harvard in his recently published book, now about a year and a half old, called Stumbling on Happiness. Gilbert argues that what we need to make us happy are delusions. And let me quote him. This guy thinks he's very clever, and you'll see just how clever he is. If we were to experience the world exactly as it is, we'd be too depressed to get out of bed in the morning. But if we were to experience the world exactly as we want it to be, we'd be too deluded to find our slippers. How do we manage to think of ourselves as great drivers, talented lovers, and brilliant chefs when the facts of our lives include a pathetic parade of dented cars, disappointed partners, and deflated souffles? The answer is simple. We cook the facts. Well, but this, in my opinion, is far too cynical and too clever by half. After all, Gilbert expects us to believe that he is not cooking facts. He alone is not cooking the facts. Why should he be the only one who's allowed to tell the truth about life? And why should he expect us to pay attention and not instead cling to our delusions? But there's no doubt that he has a piece of the truth here. You know, I think of T.S. Eliot's famous saying, humankind cannot bear very much reality. A statement that certainly a Christian, and particularly a Reformed Calvinist-type Christian, but really all of us can endorse. And there's much to be said for being less self-conscious in our devotion to the pursuit of happiness. Like the project of finding yourself, the pursuit of happiness may be something best done indirectly when you're looking for something else. Consider these words of John Stuart Mill. Yes, I'm quoting John Stuart Mill. It's something I rarely do, but these are wonderful words. Ask yourself whether you are happy and you cease to be so. Those only are happy who have their minds fixed on some object other than their own happiness, on the happiness of others, on the improvement of mankind, even on some art or pursuit followed not as a means but itself as an ideal end. Aiming thus at something else, they find happiness by the way. Or as someone else put it many years before Mill, and I think a bit more succinctly, seek ye first the kingdom of God. And we do well to remember that happiness is still, in some sense, just as revocable as the ancient Greeks thought it was. We are brought short by this terrifying fact, something we really do not expect. True, the physical world is much less mysterious to us. We don't cringe or tremble before an angry Zeus or other sky god when it thunders. But the vagaries of the human heart are as mysterious as they ever were, and every earthly happiness that we enjoy is still a happiness that can be taken away and leave behind the greatest unhappiness imaginable. Permit me to provide an illustration of this. It comes from a letter written by Nadez Mandelstam in October of 1938 to her husband, the Russian poet Osip Mandelstam. He had been arrested by the Stalinist authorities for having years before written verses that were deemed subversive, and he was taken away to a frozen, remote prison, his fate unknown to her, to his wife. This letter was her response, and it is in its own way a powerful meditation on the revocability of happiness, and I think it will have the ring of truth even for those who are happily married in our very much more comfortable time and place. Millions of people, she says, wrote such letters in Stalinist Russia to their husbands, sons, brothers, or simply to sweethearts, knowing full well the letters might never be delivered or read. And in January, the year after she wrote the letter, she learned that Osip was dead. But here's this is not all the letter, but it's a fairly lengthy passage, so indulge me, please. Osia, beloved, faraway sweetheart, I have no words, my darling, to write this letter that you may never read, perhaps. I'm writing it into empty space. Perhaps you will come back and not find me here. Then this will be all you have left to remember me by. Osia, what a joy it was living together like children, all our squabbles and arguments, the games we played, and our love. Now I do not even look at the sky. If I see a cloud, who can I show it to? Remember the way we brought back provisions to make our poor feasts in all the places where we pitched our tent like nomads. Remember the good taste of bread when we got it by a miracle and ate together. And our last winter in Voronezh, our happy poverty and the poetry you wrote. I remember the time we were coming back from the baths when we bought some eggs or sausage and a cart went by loaded with hay. It was still cold and I was freezing in my short jacket, but nothing like what you must be suffering now. I know how cold you are. That day comes back to me now. I understand so clearly and ache from the pain of it that those winter days with their troubles were the greatest and last happiness to be granted us in life. My every thought is about you. My every tear and smile is for you. I bless every day and every hour of our bitter life together, my sweetheart, my companion, my blind guide in life. Like two blind puppies we were, nuzzling each other and feeling so good together. And how fevered your poor head was, and how madly we frittered away the days of our life. What joy it was, and how we always knew what joy it was. Life can last so long, how hard and long for each of us to die alone. Can this fate be for us who are inseparable? Puppies and children, did we deserve this? Did you deserve this, my angel? Everything goes on as before. I know nothing, and yet I know everything. Each day and hour of your life are plain and clear to me as in a delirium. You came to me every night in my sleep, and I kept asking what had happened, but you did not reply. In my last dream, I was busy buying food for you in a filthy hotel restaurant. When I woke up, I said to Shura, daughter, Osia is dead. I do not know whether you are still alive, but from the time of that dream, I've lost track of you. I do not know where you are. Will you hear me? Do you know how much I love you? I could never tell you how much I love you. I cannot tell you even now. I speak only to you, only to you. You are with me always. And I, who was such a wild and angry one and never learned to weep simple tears, now I weep and weep and weep. There's so much to say about this beautiful, wrenching letter. Although, in some sense, one wants to let it speak for itself. But let me say three things about it. First, it tells us that happiness is fragile and revocable. That is our human condition. The Greeks and the other ancients were right about that. Second, that our awareness of happiness may be keenest in both senses of the word keen, not only strong but sharp, in times of recollection after a profound loss. And third, following, I think, from the second, that profound human happiness is unimaginable without suffering. Man, said the poet William Butler Yeats, man is in love and loves what vanishes. Yet the fact of our suffering and grief is also a sign to us, a guarantee that our moments of happiness are not illusions. We cannot grieve for the loss of something unless we first have loved it intensely, as Nadia loved her Osia. Without knowing the loss of someone or something genuinely precious, our hearts would never know the depth of yearning that leads us to seek God with all our strength. That is one of the many meanings behind the great beatitude, blessed are they that mourn, for they shall be comforted. We trust in the reality of God's sovereignty, but we also believe in the reality of our human attachments and the suffering that they entail. And we know that we're right to do so because we know that Christ himself suffered in his tears of disappointment with us, in his experiences of pain and abandonment on the cross. The suffering of Christ should remind us always that Christianity is not Stoicism or Buddhism. It's not a faith that's designed to insulate us from the pain that our earthly affects and attachments will cause us. Blessed are they that mourn. Blessed because we know that God works in mysterious ways to redeem our suffering, to transmute even our most overwhelming grief, and use it to open us to an even more full and greater life, and to a happiness that we could never otherwise have envisioned or even suspected. That is the object of our hope, the substance of our faith, and the source of our love. To live a life thus animated by the assumptions of faith, hope, and love, that is, like happiness itself, a matter of having the right expectations. Thank you all very much.